Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the bankrupt Epicenter complex gets new life and a rebrand. Its new owners explain their vision for what they call Queen City Quarter. It rolls trippingly off the tongue. Katz unveils design options for a new uptown bus station, which leads to serious concerns on council about conflict of interest in the process. South Carolina puts the brakes on efforts to pass a restrictive abortion law, at least for now. More disappointing test scores for CMS. The 9th District saga continues with ballot fraud plea agreements. And after tearing through Florida, leaving a path of historic destruction in its wake, Hurricane Ian heads towards us. Here to talk about those stories and more is Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter. Good morning to you. Katie Peralta Soloff is editor and reporter for Axios Charlotte. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nick Oxner is chief investigative reporter and executive producer of Investigations at WBTV. Hello to you.
Hello.
And Joe Bruno is back with us from WSOC-TV Channel 9. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Good morning. And before we start with all the other stories, let me welcome Brad Panovich, who is the chief meteorologist at WCNC-TV. So talk about what we can expect today from Hurricane Ian. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has characterized the storm's destructive path through his state as historic. The pictures are unbelievable, and I'm sure that they do not tell the real story. And yesterday, after leaving the Sunshine State, it headed for South Carolina over open water, meaning it's become a hurricane, Category 1 hurricane again. When is it predicted to come ashore, Brad?
Well, right now, it looks like it's probably going to be mid-afternoon, 2 to 3 p.m., but it really depends on where it comes ashore, because as you know, the angle of the South Carolina coast kind of runs southwest to northeast. So if it continues to jog east, it would take longer to come ashore. If it jogs to the west, then it's going to be a much quicker landfall. But it roughly looks to be mid-afternoon, somewhere between Charleston and Myrtle Beach, maybe in that Georgetown area, lower part of the Grand Strand looks to be kind of where the center, at least, is going to come ashore.
And yesterday they were calling for, I think, a 7-foot storm surge wherever it comes ashore. Is that still what they're calling for?
Yeah, probably. That was in Charleston Harbor, which luckily it looks like it passed just to the east of Charleston, so they didn't get the full brunt of that northeast quadrant. So they did get flooding down there. It takes very little to cause flooding in Charleston, but not as bad as it could have been. It looks like the bigger surge will be in Charleston, kind of the south side of the Myrtle Beach area, and might be more in that 3 to 5 foot surge. But it's crazy how wide this system is. I mean, we track the center, but the tropical storm force winds extend out about 450 miles. Yikes. So you don't need to be anywhere near the center. There's surge impacts all the way to the Outer Banks and even up into the tidewater region of Virginia. So there will be surge up and down the entire East Coast as it kind of acts like a giant nor'easter more than a tropical system.
Both states, North and South Carolina, declared the states of emergency yesterday. And as North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper made his declaration, he told people to get ready and he talked about the state's preparedness.
Sometimes we have these storms where there's just a torrential amount of rain in one particular place and we have these flash floods that can really hurt. So we need to make sure that people are ready for this and any other storm event.
Declaring a state of emergency actually has a practical application to it. It allows operation or activation of the state's emergency operations plan. It waives transportation rules to help move fuel and supplies, and it helps first responders and agriculture interests. It also protects consumers from price gouging during all this. Yesterday, you, Brad, were predicting that today would be absolutely ugly, your words, in Charlotte. Paint that picture for us. What are we expecting?
Yeah, it's more just, I would say, kind of a horrible day from a weather standpoint, but not completely dangerous right now because it's only 53 degrees out there right now. And we've got a northeast wind at 20 to 25 and it's pouring rain. So this feels kind of like an English Scottish kind of day where you got wind and rain out there, New England, Seattle kind of day. But it's really not dangerous until probably later this afternoon and this evening as the winds pick up and the center gets closer to us. Then we could see gusts of 40 or 50 miles per hour. And everybody in the Charlotte area knows it takes very little around here to bring down our beautiful trees. We tend to have trees come down in the slightest breeze. So I expect we'll have a few trees come down, which inevitably brings down a power line here and there. So power outages and trees coming down would be our biggest concern later this afternoon into tonight. And I really think the rainfall, while it is going to be heavy, it may be not as bad as we might think because we've been so dry. We had 17 consecutive days with no rain in Charlotte, which is the longest dry streak since October of 2019. So we actually need the rain. If we could have spread it out a little bit more, we can handle it. But if we get a heavy downpour for an extended period of time, we could still see flash flooding because dry ground, impervious surfaces like the development here in Charlotte, we get rapid runoff. We could see a quick flash flood occur into the evening hours. But it really is kind of a miserable day because of the temperatures. I mean, if you go outside, it does not feel like a tropical storm. It's not hot and humid. It's cold out there and it's raw.
Out of an abundance of caution, CMS and other school districts in the area have gone remote learning today. Did they make the right choice?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it's an easy call now because you have virtual. I mean, it's like, why even risk it? You know?
Yeah, but we know that doesn't work. We know that doesn't work very well. So,
but at least it gives schools an option where they can make the call a little bit easier. And I think a lot of folks, especially old school, will say, why are these kids not going to school? Well, it has a lot to do with the school buses. As we've learned in South Carolina, once the winds, they have a state regulation. Once the winds get above like 30, 35 miles an hour, the buses are not allowed to operate on the road. So it has a lot to do with the high profile vehicles of buses being on the road. And today I think it's a good call because as anybody knows, rush hour on a Friday is always horrible. When it's raining and it's rush hour, it's just chaos in the city. Yeah. And that is going to be when the worst weather hits today is during the Friday evening rush hour. So I think not having all those kids on the roads in buses and carpool lines was probably the best call they could have made.
So the last storm track that I saw had it coming ashore exactly where you said, between Myrtle Beach and Charleston, somewhere around Georgetown, and then taking a track through the Carolinas that puts it just east of Charlotte at some point in the evening tonight, and then up near the Hickory area at, I think, 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Is that still the track? And I know that you said, or the forecaster said yesterday, that this area is not favorable for the formation of tornadoes out of this storm. So is it just going to be rain for Charlotte and the immediate area, or will we see any significant winds?
The winds will pick up later tonight, but we are not going to see tornadoes. It's just that the same reason it's so cold out there, that stabilizes the atmosphere. There's no real threat for tornadoes. That's more on the coast and the coastal plain. The track has shifted a little bit east. It's probably going to be more east of Charlotte with the track taking it up towards maybe toward Martinsburg, Virginia by tomorrow morning. So it's going to be moving pretty quickly. And just to the east of us means it shifts the heavier rain just a little bit further east and probably reduces our rainfall totals more in the 1 to 3 inch range, as opposed to maybe 3 to 6 inches, which could fall in Raleigh or Fayetteville or those areas. The winds will pick up. I think they're going to kind of catch you off guard. It's pretty breezy now, but by 4, 5, 6 o'clock as the center gets close to us, which will be passing just to our east, on the northwest side, that's where the strongest winds are today. So we're likely going to see that northwest quadrant produce some really gusty winds, maybe a 2 or 3 hour period where all of a sudden the winds are howling 45, 50 miles an hour. And people are like, oh, here's the storm. It's finally here. But all in all, it's just a rainy, cold, windy day with that period in the evening where we could see the strong winds. You know, in the grand scheme of things, Mike, and of all the systems we've seen, this is kind of relatively tame compared to a lot of systems we felt. It's got this track record of causing such destruction in Florida that I think people have heightened awareness to it.
Yeah, tame for us, tragic for Florida. It's unbelievable.
I mean, it's horrific down there. I mean, the scenes, you said it, it's just... that is a highly populated area of Florida, a very vulnerable, older population, a lot of transplants that have never gone through hurricanes. So I think we haven't really grasped the full scope of what has happened down there, and we probably won't for the next couple of days.
And they'll be in the soup literally for years, because it will take years to recover from this. And a lot of people, those who got out of Florida when they were told to leave, actually did. And Joe, you spoke with several people passing through Charlotte, including one person who was on the final flight out of Tampa.
My company actually sent me here to work to get out of the area. My husband and my mother are still at home, so they're hunkering down in my house, and hopefully they come out okay.
A little nervous leaving, praying for the whole state of Florida that it somehow makes a sharp turn left or right, and it won't be as devastating as they say it will be. We brought important papers and, you know, family items and that kind of stuff. It's just scary because we sold our other house and we could end up without a home.
You also reported, Joe, that the Charlotte Motor Speedway opened their campground to Ian evacuees. Do they have many takers?
No, not that we're aware of. Yeah, it's just kind of surreal to think about packing everything up, throwing all of your documents in the car and then heading north to as far north as you can go and finding a place to stay and not knowing what it will look like when you come back. And then I just can't imagine being in their place right now, turning on the news and seeing the images of Fort Myers and Sarasota County. It's just incredible and heartbreaking.
Meteorologists predicted this storm would slow down over the Carolinas, and depending upon how the storm moves, I suppose rainfall amounts could change. You've talked about the possibility, Brad, of flash floods here in this area. How much rain are we talking? How many inches of rain do you think we'll get?
Well, in the Charlotte area, I think the greater Charlotte area, you're probably looking at 1 to 3 inches. But as you go east towards the Sand Hills and central North Carolina, that's where the totals could ramp up to 3 to 6 inches of rain. So the heavier rain bands will shift east, which is not great for them. But the worrisome part about this initially was this would be more towards the mountains and we would get that upslope or that heavy rain on the eastern facing slopes. And that's an area where 3 to 6 inches of rain on that topography would cause massive flash flooding and landslides and all kinds of issues. So it's a little bit of a saving grace that it shifted a little further east and the heavier rain will be more over the central part of the state, which will likely be able to hold that water a little bit better than they could in the mountains.
And for those who have coastal concerns between Charleston and Myrtle Beach, what should they anticipate? At one point, they were talking about a water surge and surf enough to go through the dunes, at least.
Yeah.
What are they talking about now? What do you think will happen there?
I think the surge is going to be a little bit less because of where it's hitting. We've got a little bit better protection there towards the Grand Strand. The Charleston area was the big concern because it's so susceptible to storm surge. 7 feet of water going into Charleston Harbor would have been like a top five water event for the harbor. So that would have been really significant for that area. But as you go up the coast, there are dunes that will probably be bypassed, but they will help protect a lot of property. Actually, a lot of the flooding, I think, is going to happen from the intercoastal side, because what happens is this surge comes in, it pushes water into the intercoastal waterway and the marshes and bayous behind these barrier islands. And then the tide isn't able to go out. So then the next high tide gets even higher. And so you end up seeing water coming from that side and not from the ocean side. So some of the highest water levels could be in these marshy areas on the other side of these islands.
Adam, I have a minute left. And I think it was the largest storm to hit, the fourth largest storm to hit Florida in recent memory. Would it be accurate to say it was one of the biggest hurricanes to hit the continental United States?
It's going to be up there. You know, it was the fourth strongest at landfall in Florida, which is amazing when you think about all the hurricanes that have hit Florida. But 150 mile per hour winds at landfall does place it at number four. And what's crazy, it's the seventh category 4 or 5 hurricane since 2017 to strike the United States on the Gulf Coast.
So is this the new norm? I mean, we're talking about climate change and global warming. Are we going to see more and more and more of these?
The thing we're going to see is stronger storms. The interesting thing about climate change is it increases wind shear and actually lowers the number of storms, but the storms that do form tend to be stronger and slower moving. So you're going to see more violent storms that move slower when they do make landfall, and that's the real concern.
WCNC Chief Meteorologist Brad Panovich, thank you for dropping by and filling us in on Hurricane Ian. I appreciate it. More of the News Roundup coming up on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. We're here with Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter, Katie Peralta Soloff, editor at Axios Charlotte, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, and Nick Oxner from WBTV. Charlotte Area Transit System Chief Executive John Lewis, back in the news, laid out proposals for the new Uptown bus station before City Council this week and told council members that the city had hired an independent consultant to review the proposals. But Steve, you report that both city documents and a private developer say that isn't exactly accurate. Explain that.
Yeah, so in the meeting, John Lewis was walking through different proposals for this bus station. One is to put it underground, which is what the developer favors. That's what the developer and the city really want. They've talked about that before earlier this summer. Council had some pushback against that. And so then the city said, okay, we're going to look at different options, below ground, at street level, and even on the second or third floor. And so the question is, you know, since the developer has already kind of tipped their hand and said this is what they want, should there be kind of an independent analysis in terms of a pure transit perspective in terms of what's best for passengers? And so Councilmember Ed Driggs asked, and Dimple Ajmera as well, asked John Lewis kind of like, who are the people who were reviewing this? And, you know, who do they work for? And John Lewis listed these two consultants, Kim Lee Horn and Perkins Eastman, and said very clearly multiple times, they are working for the city. They are our consultants. And that's just not true.
And that is where Dimple Ajmera comes into this. She asked John Lewis directly if the city should have hired a third party to study what is best.
Because it's the firm that is a sister company of the one that will be potentially developing this. Could you please elaborate on that and how we would be ensured that this will be an objective process throughout?
And Lewis said the process for selecting the firm was legal and that there was no conflict of interest, but Ajmera disagreed.
There are two parties. One is the vendor that submitted a proposal for development, and one who is actually helping us assess the options, whether we will have the transit center underground, at the grade level, or some other location.
And she asked if he was following her line of questioning. He said he was, but he insisted that a third party was doing the analysis.
We have a proposal that was submitted by the development team. The evaluation is being done by CAT's third party.
The developer is not doing
the evaluation. We have engaged our own consultants to help us work through the evaluation.
Again, that is not what the city documents say. And Republican Councilman Ed Driggs asked a specific question about the consulting firm.
Who are the consultants that we're using for the evaluation?
So we have on our staff is Kim Lee Horn. Perkins Eastman and Kim Lee Horn is on the CAT side of the equation.
Right, and those are outside consultants?
Are outside consultants, right. Yes.
So would it be accurate, Steve, to say that that's not true?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, John Lewis later the next day said that he misunderstood Ed Driggs's question. I mean, it seems pretty clear from what we just heard that those two companies, like I said, they're working for the developer, and the developer's kind of already said, we think it's best to put the bus station underground for their development. CATS then kind of said, well, we have some other consultants that are going to do this work. But, you know, I think that to me in this, watching this whole thing is, you know, the city's now said, well, we don't know what we're going to do. We're going to take an even-handed look at all three of these. But to me, kind of the tip off is that during this process, John Lewis was also asked, kind of theoretically, can we say it's more expensive to put the bus station underground? I mean, that's a pretty basic question. I think that's pretty obvious. It's going to cost many, many millions of more dollars to do this. And he wouldn't say that. I mean, that's just very obvious. And he wouldn't say that yes, it's going to be more expensive to put it underground, because that's really the big, once you put a price tag to this, that really makes it harder to do. And the fact that they won't state the obvious is just a bit of a head scratcher.
Nick?
Let's just put John Lewis's answers that you heard there about the bus center redesign into the context of every other answer John Lewis has given on anything he's been asked by city council in the last year. And yet again, John Lewis is looking at the city council members, his bosses, and telling them things that are objectively disproven by fact. He's done it with who runs the bus system. He's doing it now with the transit center redesign. It is mind-boggling that the council and the city staff and the city manager puts up with this.
Plus, as we pointed out, he was asked, as you heard on the tape, that he was asked direct questions about the consultant firm several times, and now he says he misunderstood. I'm not sure how that's possible, since he was asked direct questions and he answered them directly at the time. Mayor Vi Lyles was on this program on Tuesday, and I asked her about how all of this looks, and never mind anything else, but how it all looks. She would not make any judgment as to optics, but did make assurances that the contract with the consultant meets all the federal regulations.
I think we're going to follow what the rules of law of operation that we have to have and do.
She did say that she has asked the city attorney to get with the Katz attorney and determine whether there is any conflict. When might that decision be reached, do you think, Steve?
So they put out, I think the attorneys did weigh in yesterday and put out an email last night saying there is no conflict. And I mean, I think that's correct based on the law. There's no, not like they're breaking any laws. It's just the question of, does it make sense to rehire the same company, you know, that you want this even-handed analysis in terms of what's best for transit. And clearly this project is being driven by what's best for the developer. They want to make money. They want to put the bus station underground. And so it's just the question is, it's not so much legality. It's just in terms of, like, does it make sense?
I want to come back to that. Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, that was the when Dimple Ejmyr was questioning John Lewis, they kind of defaulted to that, saying, well, if you're alleging something improper, we have attorneys and that's a serious allegation. But the concern isn't whether this is illegal. It's about whether taxpayers are getting the best deal and the experience will be the smoothest for riders.
Well, why would any entity, anybody, if you want to redo your kitchen and you have a designer who owns a construction company, would you necessarily go with their quote or would you bid it out? I mean, I don't understand why a project this expensive, you would rely on the expertise of a company associated with the developer who wants to do the job.
This is a pattern we have seen from the city, where the city has a predetermined result in mind. It works towards that. And you have to ask yourself, is this in the best interest of the taxpayers? And to the extent that the city council has let this pattern play out over and over and over again, is anyone in the city staff or anyone on the city council willing to stand up, ask these tough questions, and actually stop the train running down the predetermined track? We haven't seen that on previous projects. Maybe this will be the change.
And I think one of the things, Nick, okay. I mean, I'm sorry, I'll just say real quick. You know, one of the key parts of our former government, the council manager former government, that really kind of works to city staff advantage is that we have elections every 2 years. We just brought in new council members. They're just by their nature, they're inexperienced. And so they're kind of always, the council is always behind in terms of like knowing what's going on. And so city staff is able to lead them to, often usually lead them to the outcome that they want, and not necessarily, it's hard for the elected officials to be on top of things when they're often so new.
Are you saying that Charlotte has a deep state?
I say that the city staff knows just 100 times more than their bosses.
Meanwhile, Joe, Katz will be holding what they're calling pop-up meetings on whether the station should be at street level, elevated, or underground. I've never heard the elevated design option. When and where will these meetings be held?
Yeah, so just a little bit of context about the project. The Transit Center has been here since 1995. It's outlived its purpose. It's kind of designed poorly for the 21st century here. You know, the retail doesn't really face outward to the public. It's not really an activator. You have to dodge buses if you want to move from one side of the transit center to the other. And then you have the streetcar. You have to cross a busy street to access the buses, and the light rails on top and not easy to connect to the buses. So it is clear that it needs to be redesigned in some capacity. And so Katz is asking residents where the buses should be in this new terminal. So they're talking about putting them underground, which we just discussed, leaving them at street level, which would look like it does right now, or elevating them in a terrace that essentially would be on the same platform as the blue line. So a little bit in the air, maybe 20, 25 feet in the air there. So this week or this upcoming week, the 4th through the 6th, they'll be out at the Transit Center asking residents what they think about that.
Okay. Meanwhile, Katie, North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis weighed in on several topics this week at a chat with the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance. Among the topics, the $13.5 billion Charlotte Transportation and Mobility Plan, which of course includes the East-West Silver Line from Matthews to Belmont. City Council's Ed Driggs was there, and he asked Tom Tillis, "Can City Council camp outside your office? What's the best way we can improve our chances?" I guess he was talking about our chances for getting federal funding or for part of this project. What was the senator's response?
So I think that's the biggest question on everybody's minds when it comes to transit and working with federal officials. And Tillis is pretty transparent, in my opinion. He basically said that if Charlotte wants to differentiate itself from other markets seeking federal funding, which there are many, then the goal is to, really kind of set your plan apart and demonstrate how you can be sort of a regional amenity for not just the county and the city, but kind of throughout the state as well. So I thought that was much more optimistic than I had heard before. And I think it sort of opens the door to how creative Charlotte can get with its asks for federal funds for this massive project.
Well, he's from the northern part of Mecklenburg County. I know he represents the entire state, but that's where he has a residence. And they have said they're not on board with this transit plan at all unless they get rail. Surely he's aware of that.
Yes, surely he is. It's easier said than done, though. It's going to be very interesting to see how those conversations about, the red line continue and evolve, because that is something that is continued to be studied during this process. And no updates there, really, but okay. We'll see.
Well, after several aborted attempts to hold an auction to sell the bankrupt Epicenter complex, it finally went through last month or a month or so ago. And this week, the new owner talked about their plans, which include a rebranding for Epicenter. It shall now and forevermore, at least for a week or two, be known as Queen City Quarter. Why the name? I'm not sure to ask this of Katie. I'll go with you.
Yeah, I asked the same question myself, actually, after they announced it. It's a major change from the Epicenter. It's also the vision that the owners have is much different from, the hour-long lines and the rowdy nightlife, the nightclubs that we're kind of used to from the Epicenter's heyday. They described the new vision as one that is family-friendly, with high-end retail and restaurants. We don't have the names of any new tenants yet, but it certainly creates a vision that's perhaps quieter. Investing a lot in security measures. They'll have staff on site to enforce security, and we'll see if it results in any major.
For those who have never been to Epicenter, and there are lots of people who have never set foot in the place, it was a place for bars and restaurants, clubs. I had a movie, multiple movie screen movie theater. We could actually have dinner while you're watching the movie. It had a bowling alley, I believe, and it had a CVS. How they got in there, I don't know. But the new management firm says their new plans is to continue to make it an entertainment venue, but have a vibrant corporate and family-friendly feel. That sounds like an oxymoron to me, but here's how CBRE's Sabrina Jones described the company's vision.
We're absolutely targeting shopping, soft services, and in addition to the restaurants. So adding, again, to that daytime population, but then also turning it into a place where folks want to stay even after hours and into their evening, grabbing dinner before a show, things that would appeal to both the community and visitors.
Yeah, but what's it going to be? I mean, how will it be different? How do you control the vibrancy, I'll use that word, of the place?
I could envision like late night restaurants that aren't necessarily clubs. Like I'm just thinking of maybe a Hickory Tavern type restaurant, an Angry Ale, something that serves bar food that you could attend that restaurant before and after a game and maybe get a drink, but not necessarily hear house music and get bottle service later after the Hornets play. And, you know, high-end retail is something that Uptown desperately needs, but I'm just going to be skeptical until I see a list of tenants that comes by CBRE.
Yeah, and it's a lot.
I think also thinking about the day that when they talk about the daytime crowd, they're talking about those office workers that have really yet to come back. So it's sort of a question of what comes first. You know, can the Epicenter help spur some of that daytime activity, you know, the lunch crowd, or does it take the lunch crowd coming back from these uptown towers to kind of bring the Epicenter back to life? And obviously with the latter option, you really can't control that. It's a really hard ask to bring in some of these quote high-end retailers if the foot traffic is just not there to begin with. So I would have to imagine that it would be like really, really hot names that would have to come there in order to draw in the crowd. And, you know, we've asked readers before what this would look like. Everybody says, you know, Zara, you know, Charlotte doesn't have a physical Zara. If you had something like, you know, like a really popular lunch chain, like a Shake Shack or something like that. These are not easy retailers to land. So the prospect of actually getting them to a center that has quite frankly died in the last couple of years is a pretty big ask.
Yeah. I think Katie and my wife are the two biggest proponents of a Zara in Charlotte. So.
I'm not a proponent of a Zara. I'm just echoing just talk what about the readers lot. Say.
I don't even
we
know
sure
what it
do
is.
Because it's...
and it's a lot of space. People don't understand just how big Epicenter is. It's a lot of space. So we'll see what happens. We only have a minute left, and I'll have to start something and finish it on the other side of the break. But Charlotte Douglas International Airport is under perpetual construction, and some recent changes have some people a little unhappy, Joe. It has to do with the canopy being erected at the departures drop-off area. What's going on?
It's a disaster. all of the traffic has to enter through the arrivals. If you're entering from Wilkinson, budget like an hour just to get to the terminal so you don't miss your flight. But it is a mess, and it will be a mess for at least a week and a half more.
Okay, so we'll talk a little bit more about that. And there's some other things going on at the airport. They're moving the overlook. I'm not even sure what that is. Also, South Carolina has nixed their very restrictive abortion bill, at least for now. And there was a verdict, a sentencing, I think, in the ballot fraud situation down in the 9th Congressional District in Bladen County. We'll get to that in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison is with us from WFAE News. Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV. Katie Peralta-Soloff from Axios Charlotte. Nick Oxner from WBTV. So this construction at the airport dealing with the canopy being erected over the departures area of the airport has closed the road there to traffic, I think, until October the 12th. It's 146,000 square foot canopy. I've seen a picture of it. It's very attractive. Is it practical? Does it do anything? Or is it just for beauty's sake?
Maybe it'll keep you out of the rain. I'm not sure. It looks nice. The airport needs to look nice. Sixth busiest in the world. But for now, it is a pain if you have to pick someone up or get to the airport yourself.
You reported also this week, Joe, that the airport overlook is closing on October the 3rd. That's Monday because of construction. And a temporary overlook will be opened on October the 17th with a more permanent one in the design phase. I only go to the airport to leave or return. Is this overlook for people who want to watch planes take off and land.
Yeah, I can't believe you've never been. It's a nice place. Like, they bring food trucks out there. It's fun. You know, a lot of people have young kids bring their kids out there to watch the planes. People have cameras, aviation enthusiasts. They take pictures as the planes land. It is a popular place, and they're going to build a small, like, there's a temporary smaller location. I believe it's at Old Dowd Road Airport Overlook Drive or some intersection like that. I don't think it's as nice as the current Overlook, but they're going to design a new one because this new runway that takes the place that is going to be built will be taking the place of the current Overlook.
I just didn't check it out sometime. I didn't know that was still a thing. My parents used to take us as kids to an Overlook at National Airport, but that was to see the Wright brothers take off and land. So I didn't know that was still a thing. South Carolina legislators tried but failed to pass one of the more restrictive abortion laws in the country a couple weeks ago, outlawing nearly all abortions in the state it would have, including in cases of rape or incest. Members of the House refused to pass the Senate version, which would have moderated the bill. And when the Senate version came to the House for a vote, State Representative John McCravey urged members to vote against it.
I don't believe we intended to come back to Columbia and work all summer to simply pass a law that we already have. I certainly didn't come back for that, and I don't think you came back for that. We came back to pass a law to advance the cause of life in South Carolina.
Senate members have repeatedly said they do not have sufficient votes to pass such a restrictive law. So two questions. Why the big difference between the Senate and the House in South Carolina? And is this dead and done, or is it likely to come back in a new session later on?
So it's interesting, the genesis of the differences, because initially the bill in the Senate was functionally identical to what the House has passed of their own. And it was through the amendment process and during debate in the Senate that these certain exemptions, you know, allowing abortions in cases of rape or incest were voted in, were amended. The bill was amended to allow that. And this is after we heard not a flood, but several Republican senators in South Carolina speak publicly about realizing the consequences and impact of a total abortion ban, which is what the House wants to pass. And so this is a real genesis that I think kind of reflects some of the debate that's happening all across the country on this issue. So through some parliamentary maneuvering, the Senate passes this with just a couple slight exceptions. It gets to the House, and as we just heard, the House said, absolutely not, we're not doing that. And I'll be curious to see if they can rectify these differences when they come back for their full session. This was a special session for this issue, and they come back in their full session next year.
Are they waiting for the midterms, or would they be smart to wait to see what happens in the midterms, given that there's a anticipation of a pink wave?
The votes were taken here months before the midterms, right? And so and in South Carolina, I don't think we're going to see a bunch of Democrats elected to the General Assembly in 2022. So.
Okay, so back to the story that consumed us for years and really consumed you, Nick, and I think, Joe, you covered this story liberally as well, and it's a story that apparently is never going to end. It's the saga of the election fraud in Bladen County in the 9th Congressional District. On Monday, four people pleaded guilty to misdemeanors for their roles in the fraud. Who were they? What were they charged with?
On a fifth pleaded guilty yesterday to the same charge. So these are all associates of McRae Dowless. Associates is a strong word. These are all people that McRae Dowless paid to work for him in elections. Keep in mind, McRae Dowless is the political operative who was at the center of this controversy. He died in April before he could stand trial for his charges. But essentially what he was accused of was collecting absentee ballots from voters illegally. It's a crime in North Carolina. And what he was charged with was collecting that and having a scheme to collect that and sending his people out there to do that and sending them in. So these folks who pleaded guilty this week were charged with felonies that include possession of absentee ballots and felony obstruction of justice, essentially for having them and maybe taking some steps to cover it up or to coordinate this. What they pleaded to is a misdemeanor conspiracy to possess an absentee ballot. They'll face no jail time and they'll do 100 hours of community service.
Wow. Is that a sufficient sentence, you think, for something that caused such a turmoil in our election system for so long?
Joe, you can answer that, but I have something I want to say afterwards.
Okay, Lauren Freeman thinks so. I talked to her yesterday, and she said
she's the DA.
She's the DA for Wake County. She says these people were working for McRae. McRae was the person leading the operation, and in her view, 100 hours of community service is sufficient.
And on the other side, we have to put into perspective, and if I may, Mike, please indulge me for a second. Everyone should buy my book, The Vote Collectors.
I knew that was coming.
When you become, you lose all any shame when you become an author, which is, centers on the 9th Congressional District scandal. But these are people largely who are marginalized in Bladen County, who are looking for work and need work. Many of these folks have criminal records of another sort, unrelated to any involvement with McRae Dallas. And so it's hard to reckon that these people were out maliciously, to the extent they did anything, and I guess they've now admitted they did something, maliciously out to ruin democracy. Folks on the other side of this would allege that these much lesser charges and these pleas that Lauren Freeman has cut is just evidence that she didn't have a strong case to begin with. I've seen the entire criminal discovery file. I was really looking forward to seeing how she convicted McRae Dallas. Just not saying he didn't do things. I'm saying I know what evidence she has, and it's not what the public thinks.
Okay. On Wednesday, CMS released data that shows just 8.2% of high schoolers are testing at the highest level of the end-of-year exams, I think in math. The goal is to have at least 26% testing at those levels, which seems to me to be woeful. But given what's come before in terms of test results, was any of this a surprise? Steve?
I don't think so. And I think one caveat, and I'm not a total expert on this, but some of those math scores tend to be low on the high school math scores because some of CMS's best students take those math classes in middle school, I believe. And so they're often not counted. But yes, to your point earlier, in terms of a surprise, during the pandemic, math scores in Charlotte and across the country went down really, really went down a lot. The idea is, I mean, math is something you only do at school. You don't do it at home. You needed to be in person. So the big area to catch up in here and everywhere is math.
And what those mean, the highest levels, if you can pass the math test at the highest levels, it means that you are ready for a job or you are ready to go to college. So only 8.2% are passing that. I don't even know where to begin with that. And Interim Superintendent Hugh Hadabaugh has said that a lot of this problem is due to people who simply don't come to class. If you don't come to class, you're not going to do well in school, and he's cracking down on it. Has it had any impact yet? Do we know if that's working?
I don't know if we can say it's had any impact, but I think it's interesting that Hugh Hadabaugh has said they are going to crack down on the issue of people, of kids not being in school. And under the previous superintendent, Ernest Winston, he basically said he was not going to follow state law. I think if you have more than 10 unexcused absences, the parents or the kind of the case or the student or the family is supposed to be referred to the district attorney. And the idea is not to put anyone in jail, but the idea is right to try and have some kind of stick to get parents to get their kids to school. Ernest Winston said he wasn't going to do that at all. And now under the new leadership, they are going to try and use what they have to get parents to get their children in school.
This data from this report came from a progress report that was just released on the goals they've set to address low-performing schools and low student achievement. What else, Joe, did it show? Is progress being made, or did it show other woeful results elsewhere?
Well, we looked at the English language arts scores 2 weeks ago, and they were low as well. It's clear that CMS board is going to tackle student achievement at basically every meeting that they have. But, you know, the pandemic did a number, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and the community is demanding this as well.
Republicans control the state legislature, but they don't have a supermajority, so the governor can still veto legislation that they cannot override. One of the races with the potential to change that is the race in District 98, and that is the one that includes Davidson, Cornelius, and parts of Huntersville. It's an interesting contest because it reunites the incumbent and the challenger in a competition they've had, I think, several times before now. Talk about that.
Yeah, this is a really interesting district that voted for Joe Biden, Roy Cooper, and Mark Robinson. Don't you want to meet the Joe Biden, Mark Robinson voter? It's a toss-up district as well. So these people, Christy Clark and Representative John Bradford, have run against each other twice already. Bradford won once, Clark won once. And Bradford is really pitching himself as someone who can secure funding for his district. He says, listen, I have the leadership here. I can get funding for these important projects for District 98. Clark is talking about how, you know, it's important for Democrats to be able to maintain Governor Roy Cooper's veto. So it will be a really interesting race that, you know, in every sense of the word, it is a toss-up district.
Yeah. So Steve, talk about that for a second, because Christy Clark's a Democrat and she wants to win. And she's, as Joe just said, if she wins, she'll help maintain the governor's ability to override the vetoes. Or to have a veto that can't be overridden. On the other hand, the Republican incumbent, John Bradford, is the only Republican in the Mecklenburg County delegation to the legislature, which is predominantly Republican. And that, therefore, he has their ear. Which is the stronger choice, politically speaking, for voters?
I mean, if one of your biggest issues is abortion, then and a woman's right to an abortion, then clearly you will favor Christy Clark. This is a huge deal in terms of who has it, whether Republicans have a supermajority or not. But like Joe said, this is really interesting because there's so few competitive races in Mecklenburg County. I mean, Democrats are just heavily favored in almost every single Senate and House district. There's another House race in the Southeast between Bill Brawley and Laura Budd. That one will be competitive, but almost everything else is just a total yawn.
And very quickly, a Meredith poll was released, I think yesterday, the day before, that indicates the Senate race between Sherry Beasley and Ted Budd is virtually tied. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, it's not just one poll. There are multiple polls that show this race dead even. And the support tends to be kind of low on both sides, you know, in the 44% to 44%, which, you know, that means a lot of people are undecided. But it is multiple polls put this race neck and neck.
Okay. Nationally, here in this area, a nationally known solar power company closed its doors last week in Mooresville. Pink Energy left hundreds of customers with questions about what they should do with malfunctioning and underperforming solar panels. Nick, WBTV investigated this. What did you find?
Yeah, well, there are people, hundreds, if not thousands of people who took out loans for tens of thousands of dollars, up to like $100,000 for these solar panels with promises that they would save a lot of money on their energy bills. And they keep calling us and my colleague David Hodges and saying, we haven't saved any money and we still have these expensive loans. The company abruptly closed last week. Just yesterday, North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper announced Attorney General Josh Stein, boy, that was a blast from the past, announced that he was opening an investigation. I think he's at least the third such state attorney general to do so.
And evidently, you went to Mooresville, somebody from WBTV did.
David did, not me.
Okay, and tried to talk to the president of Pink Energy. And they say, you know, your website says he did not answer any of WBTV's questions. Did you actually get to talk to him, or did they just shut the door in your face?
No, there was no talking. It just, David was there getting video and a guy happened to drive up and park in the president's spot and he took the opportunity to ask him questions. He did not answer.
So Katie, solar is hot. It seems odd that a solar company would go out of business. What seems to be the problem with Pink Energy?
It's a very strange and kind of dramatic situation. There's all this back and forth. Lawsuits are being lobbed. The company has basically blamed this other company called, I think it's Generac, G-E-N-E-R-A-C, for faulty parts that have resulted in their equipment not working. This other company has in turn said, you know, stop blaming us for your own shortcomings, own up to your mistakes, blah, blah, blah. So this is ongoing, you know, and with these investigations now underway, you know, it remains to be seen how this will all shake out for customers.
Well, we're out of time. That means Joe does not get to talk about the excitement brewing over what the world needs, the nation needs, Charlotte needs, another burger joint, and the possible arrival of Whataburger. No time, Joe. Come back next week. We'll give you extra time at the top of the show. Joe Bruner from WSOC, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Katie Peralta Soloff from Axios Charlotte, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.